Now it's time for the Talk of the Nation opinion page, and two words keep popping up in news coverage of tomorrow's Mideast Peace Conference in Maryland: low expectations. In an op-ed today, Aaron David Miller suggests that an appropriate theme song for the meeting might be Sugarland's "Everybody's Dreaming Big, But Everybody's Just Getting By." Still, he argues there is a chance for real progress if the U.S., Israelis, and Palestinians are willing to take specific steps and bigger risks. And he should know. Aaron David Miller served as an advisor to six secretaries of state on Arab-Israeli negotiations, and he was a U.S. Middle East negotiator himself. What would you consider progress at the peace conference this week? 800-989-8255. You can reach us by email, talk@npr.org. Aaron David Miller is now a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, and he joins us from a studio at the Woodrow Wilson Center. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And by the way, his op-ed ran in today's Los Angeles Times, and there's a link to it on our website at npr.org/talk. And I wonder, you wrote that this is a case study, this the Annapolis Summit, of what happens when you call a peace conference with high expectations and then reality intrudes. How do we get to the low expectations summit?
Well, I think the initial focus of the summit was not simply to launch a negotiation. It was to create a document which would guide permanent status negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians. In short, it was, at least in the beginning, a breakthrough strategy to try to create some measure of agreement on Jerusalem borders, refugees, and security that would allow Israelis and Palestinians to actually share a common basis for negotiation. And that's clearly not going to happen tomorrow and the next day.
There are statements today that there is a common statement that is expected to be issued.
I think that's true, but I think that will focus almost exclusively on the process, which in and of itself could be extremely important. The real question, Neil, I think, is will Annapolis have legs? 3 months from now, will we be having the same conversation as we've had for the last 6 or 7 years? No trust, no negotiations, and no progress. Or alternatively, will Annapolis, the event, have been translated into something quite consequential to actually close the gaps that separate the Israelis and Palestinians and begin to change the situation on the ground? That's the core test of whether Annapolis is going to succeed or fail.
And one of the first things you suggest needs to be done is to write something down on a piece of paper. Words, you quote the famous aphorism, oral statements aren't worth the paper they're printed on.
Yeah, Samuel Goldwyn, the Hollywood mogul movie producer, was a smart guy, and he's right. An oral agreement isn't worth the paper it's written on. The reality is we've had a lot of exchange of ideas. We've had informal negotiations. We had the Camp David summit in July of 2000, where, in fact, we did put a paper on the table. The fourth day, the Israelis hated it. The Palestinians didn't like it either, and we pulled it off. So in order to actually have a negotiation and an agreement, you're going to have a document which both parties can own. They consider it, they have a stake in it, but it's going to have to be a document, I suspect, in which the United States is going to have to play a critical role in drafting, because the issues are simply too hard and they need a third party.
The issues, the United States' role in all of this has accelerated considerably in the last few months. Particularly Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice has been active in trying to promote this meeting and greater progress. Her great hope is the establishment of a Palestinian state before she leaves office, before she and President Bush leave office.
That's true. I mean, I think the chances, frankly, and I've seen these movies before, of trying to create expectations that in a limited amount of time, which are not realizable, we should avoid that. The objective of the administration, if in fact they get a Palestinian state by January 2009, so much the better. But the administration ought to set it as its core objective, handing off to its successors, Republican or Democrat, two things: a negotiation which really shows the possibility that Israelis and Palestinians can reach an agreement on these issues, and an environment on the ground that is conducive to such a negotiation. In fact, the president could claim that he inherited probably the worst environment for Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking of any of his predecessors, Arafat, Sharon, in an ongoing war. If he could transform that situation and he could facilitate and help broker a political agreement and change the reality on the ground, George W. Bush, having disengaged on this issue for the last 6.5 years, could actually create a consequential accomplishment for which he would deserve enormous credit.
And that, among many other reasons, it could be among the many reasons that are really good ideas for doing this. But people look at the inherent limitations. For example, you say a meaningful document that Palestinians and Israelis can both feel as if they have a stake in. Well, which Palestinians?
And that, I think, is the 500-pound gorilla or elephant in the room. The invisible participant at Annapolis is Hamas. And the problem on the Palestinian side, and the Israelis have their own problems, but the problem on the Palestinian side is this. There is no single Palestinian negotiator or leader who at this point can control all of the guns. And I don't care if it's the District of Columbia, the government of Sweden, or the state of California. Unless you maintain a monopoly on the forces of violence within your own society, in short, you control all the guns, none of your constituents are going to respect you, and your neighbors won't either. And the real problem that Mahmoud Abbas faces is that he is speaking for part of the Palestinian community. He is controlling part of Palestinian territory, and he is articulating part of a vision. His counterpart, Hamas, based in Gaza and in Damascus, controls a fair share of the politics, the guns, the desperation, and the hopelessness that many Palestinians feel. And unless that Palestinian polity is somehow unified, it seems to me no Israeli government would ever want to make existential concessions if the partner in question, in this case Mahmoud Abbas, could not deliver on what the government of Israel needs, which is security.
And when you say control all the guns, it's not an argument about the Second Amendment. This is, in other words, control organized violence, militias, armies, police, that sort of thing.
Exactly. We have criminal elements in our society, even extremist groups, but they don't operate with the level of impunity or challenge the existing political authority and order in the way that Palestinians do in today's West Bank and Gaza. After all, you have an extraordinary example of a movement, Hamas, which actually used democratic politics and fair and free elections to gain power, and yet that government has never abandoned the armed struggle or the way of the gun. And that is going to be an extremely difficult prospect and challenge for Abbas, for Olmert, and for George W. Bush.
Let's get some listeners involved in this conversation. Our guest, by the way, Aaron David Miller, a public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C., a former U.S. Middle East negotiator. Our number is 800-989-8255. Email talk@npr.org. There's a summit meeting in Annapolis, Maryland this week. What would represent realistic progress? And let's begin with Jeff. Jeff calls us from Jacksonville in Florida.
Hey, good afternoon. How's everybody doing?
Very well, thanks.
Aaron, it's good to speak to y'all. My question is this, we've seen this before. Is this another blank document that's going to come up? I would like to see something solid out of this. I mean, it seems that the United States, we keep doing this with the Middle East, and we get a paper like the Camp David initial accords. My wife, her uncle was Roy Atherton, and Aaron, I don't know if you knew him or not. He was the ambassador to Egypt during Carter.
Mm-hmm.
And we would sit around and have discussions about this, and he, in his mind, said that he never would think that there would be peace in the Middle East. And I would love to see a solid document with a timetable, and not just the glitter, but a full power to it that gives the Israelis and the Palestinians something to work with.
Are we likely?
Okay, I'll take my comment off here.
Thank you very much for the call, Jeff. And Aaron David Miller, do you think we're likely to come out of this meeting with a timetable?
Not one that's going to make much of a difference. I don't think there was one date in the entire history of the Oslo process that was ever kept. Form will follow function here. If, in fact, there are serious negotiations between Israelis and Palestinians, truly serious and meaningful, with not only intentions but capabilities, you won't need a timetable. And if, in fact, there is no seriousness, no fixed timetable articulated by the president or anybody else is going to make much of a difference. I knew Jeff's wife's uncle, Roy Atherton, an extraordinary diplomat, a very fine man. And Roy was absolutely critical to helping the United States achieve a major success at the first Camp David in September 1978, in which then-President Jimmy Carter brokered an agreement between Israel and Egypt. And in large part, even with parties who were willing and able, tough leaders, Begin and Sadat, who were willing and able to take risks, it required an extraordinarily firm, strong, and reassuring hand on the part of the United States in order to make progress. And I think we have to understand this. No matter how prepared the parties may be, no agreement that has existed in the Arab-Israeli issue that has actually lasted, with the possible exception of the Israeli-Jordanian peace treaty of October 1994, has ever been done without American participation at some phase. And that participation requires enormous drive and determination by the president, because our own domestic politics, as well as the politics of the Arabs and the Israelis, will bury any American effort if it's not serious. And that's, it seems to me, the core question in the wake of Annapolis. Having disengaged from this issue for the last 6.5 years, is the president of the United States prepared to make the pursuit of Arab-Israeli peace a top priority for his administration in the last year? Because that's what it's going to take if we're going to get anywhere.
Our guest, Aaron David Miller, public policy scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center here in Washington, D.C. There's a link to Aaron David Miller's op-ed, which appeared in the Los Angeles Times, at npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And here's an email we have from James. Will any progress be made until Israel acknowledges the Nakba, which, of course, was the, depending on how you define it, the deportation or the flight of Palestinians in 1948? Will that remain as a bitter Palestinian memory that could poison the future? A truth and reconciliation process similar to South Africa's might work. This is the right of return, is how this is often phrased in terms of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Is that going to be, that certainly should be one of the subjects under discussion?
Well, it's going to be absolutely critical. And of the four core issues, Jerusalem, borders, and security, the last issue, refugees, is by far the most contentious, because it involves the identity of both Israelis and Palestinians, and in large part a refusal on each side to understand the importance of that identity issue and to handle it in a way that recognizes both the demographic, the historic, and the moral dimensions of this problem. I would argue to you that on the refugee issue, if in fact the other three issues break in a way that satisfy Israeli and Palestinian needs, there will in fact be the possibility of compromising on the refugee question. But it will require a package approach, which is going to probably have to satisfy Palestinian needs on territory and on Jerusalem before they're prepared to give up. And ultimately, it seems to me they will have no choice but to give up the notion that any Palestinian or his descendant who left or was forcibly expelled from Palestine, 1947, 1948, has the right to return to Israel proper. Those Palestinians will likely have the right to return to a Palestinian state. But the issue of taking away from the Israelis the sovereign right to decide who comes into their country and who doesn't is more than just a tactical political question. It gets to the very core anxieties of most Israelis. And I think that issue ultimately is going to have to be folded in to the other issues the way they're resolved.
Let's get Tom on the line. Tom's with us calling from Camp Lejeune in North Carolina. Excuse me, I'm on the wrong line. Tom, are you there?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Tom with us on line 7. Go ahead.
Hi. I just got back from Iraq about 2 months ago. So I really don't have a lot of experience with Israel. But I think, from my experience there, the only way that they're ever, ever going to even have a chance at coming to an agreement is if both sides can agree for at least time to talk to stop the violence. Because if one side attacks, the other side's going to retaliate, and it's a wicked chain, it's never going to end. And if they don't at least agree to stop to talk, there'll never be any progress ever.
The violence that we've seen in the past is at a relatively low level at the moment, Aaron David Miller, I guess with the exception of Gaza.
It's true, but it could easily, and Tom knows, given his experience in Iraq, it could easily start up again in a way that could undermine the very basis of these negotiations. You know, it's a paradox. Violence has in the past, and if you look at the 1973 war, which triggered perhaps the most serious diplomacy in the Arab-Israeli conflict until that point, was essentially triggered by the October and Yom Kippur War. The Intifada, first and second, generated a good deal of political activity, particularly the first Intifada. But violence as a partner to a negotiation simply is not going to work. And this is why the issue of security is so critical, and why the issue of maintaining a monopoly over the forces of violence in Palestinian society is so critical. On the Israeli side, there are Israeli obligations, settlement activity, curfews, land confiscation, bypass roads, collective punishment. All of these things that are and obligations that are indicated and identified in the roadmap need to be worked through by both sides. And this is where the United States is going to have to play a critical role, perhaps at times as a judge, more often as a friend, but at all times as a broker that is effective and fair. If we're not prepared to be effective and fair, we have no business in the mediation or brokering business.
Tom, welcome home. Thanks very much for the call.
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. And Aaron David Miller, thank you so much for your time today.
It's a pleasure.
Aaron David Miller, former U.S. Middle East negotiator, now at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington, D.C. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Neil Conan in Washington.